It's the Security Weekly News, episode 222. Welcome to week 10, July 2022. More 222s. We're back from holidays and so forth. Hope you enjoyed any holidays that may have occurred in your locale while we were gone. I did ask if we had Bastille Day off this week, but they said since there's no news on Wednesday, sure. But we're going to be charged for it. Today we've got James Webb, Microsoft, making money on getting ransomed, fake Cisco, Rogers Communications, the SEC, and Zettabytes. All this and Jason Wood on this episode of Security Weekly News.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more.
Right now, everybody is talking about cryptocurrency, and the cyber criminals are hiding in the conversation. Cyber criminals use social engineering loaded with urgency and fear to successfully prey on your company, your employees, and your customers. Spear phishing is just one of the 13 types of email threats. Barracuda has identified 13 types and shows you how you can protect your company, your customers, and your reputation. Find out about the 13 email threat types and Barracuda email protection by going and getting your free ebook at securityweekly.com/barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/barracuda. All right, I'm Doug White. We're back from holidays, and this is Security Weekly News. So this first story was kind of interesting to me for a couple of reasons. Not for the main reason of the story, I guess, but it was interesting to me. So Maastricht University, which is in the Netherlands, got phished. Wow, okay. You know, like nothing new there. And they got ransomware as a result of getting phished. Okay, again, nothing to see here. All the usual stuff. But after about a week of being down, and this was several years ago, but after about a week of being down, they decided to pay 30 Bitcoins as ransom, which sounds pretty expensive. So now, and this was in 2019, and the 30 Bitcoins in 2019 cost like 200,000 euros. So, you know, it's not insignificant when you're a university, especially a university in Europe. So they decided, though, that it would still be cheaper to pay the ransom than to do all the restores. Because, you know, so again, like, all right. But now, so the first interesting thing about this then is that the Netherlands Public Prosecution Service traced and seized a wallet that contained cryptocurrency that was paid by Maastricht University. I'm like, so the interesting thing about that is, you know, like, wait, they did what? So the team apparently found this wallet and they froze the wallet with all of its contents in 2020. So it's really interesting to me that law enforcement, and we've seen this before with the FBI, law enforcement is working pretty hard on tracing the supposedly untraceable cryptocurrency, because apparently it's not exactly untraceable. But anyway, and we've seen it before with the FBI. But, and of course, don't get your hopes up, you know, that they're going to be able to come save you. But maybe so. So the second interesting thing about the story was that they paid this astronomical sum back in 2019, and it was 200,000 euros. When the police recovered it, it was only worth about 40,000 euros. So, you know, it's like one of those things where they get your stuff back and it's not worth anything anymore. But today, when they actually got the money back and they've got the Bitcoins back, it's worth about 594,000 euros this morning. So, you know, cryptocurrency, can you say volatility? But anyway, yeah, it was about 594,000 euros this morning. So it's kind of an interesting story about, I guess that's a feel-good story. Yeah, all right. Are you a government agency and your Cisco gear seems a little subpar? Well, owner Axoy, the CEO of apparently dozens of different companies, which are all listed in the article, by the way, sounds legit. Yeah, like when they say you're the CEO of a dozen different companies, you immediately go, wow, that's interesting. But anyway, owner Axoy was arrested for selling more than $1 billion of counterfeit Cisco network equipment to worldwide customers, which included healthcare, military, and government organizations. I mean, when I saw that, I was like, what? How'd that happen? But anyway, you'll see. So did you ever wonder why your ASA says Crisco on it? Or maybe it says Cisco with an S and it came with a box of frozen steaks? Maybe you should ask yourself if you're getting what you thought you were getting when it's like that. But I mean, this is like buying things from Polly Walnuts, RIP, when they fall off the back of a truck in New Jersey and your Armani suit is called Irmani or something like that, or those Beats headphones you bought on Temple Street in Hong Kong that broke before you got to the airport. Yeah, that kind of stuff. But unlike all those silly examples, these pretty much apparently look like the real thing and were being sold through Amazon and eBay, which, okay, now there you go. You know, like, I want to buy a Cisco ASA firewall, and it's like on eBay from a company called Herbs, you know, Crazy Herbs, used Crisco equipment. But they were selling it through Amazon, eBay storefronts to customers all over the world. And I'm like, I'm a government agency and I'm buying stuff off eBay. Well, yeah, I bought stuff off eBay. But basically, Axway was taking older stuff, like old lower models, and they put them in new cases that had pirated Cisco software on them and all sorts of fake components in them from China, which has a whole lot of other implications, right? What they did was they modded all these components to circumvent Cisco's checks, because a lot of this equipment checks with Cisco to see if you have authentic licenses and all this stuff for iOS. The Chinese manufacturer apparently was even adding all the badging, labels, stickers, down to like the little barcodes and things from Cisco. They had Cisco boxes, packaging, because probably it came from the same factory where Cisco was making stuff. I don't know, but they made them all look legit. Well, in July of 2021, the Department of Justice from the United States seized 1,156 counterfeit Cisco devices at one of Axway's warehouses. Cisco even... And I always think this is so weird. Cisco had sent 7 letters to this guy asking him to cease and desist producing counterfeit equipment between 2014 and 2019. And obviously that really worked well because, yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, this is when the mafia gets a letter from Macy's saying, stop selling counterfeit suits, Polly Walnuts, RIP. And they just say, well, that's it, boys. We got to find a new profession. Right. So, but anyway, the article has a list of all the companies that were named as selling Cisco equipment through these different storefronts. So if you bought your Cisco equipment from Amazon or eBay, well, enough said. You might want to go down to the server room and check that out and make sure it's not got like a Chinese transmitter or something in it. Well, if you're in Canada, you probably know your internet was out and you're probably not watching the show, but I think it's back up now. But somebody actually called me and asked if I knew what it was. And I was like, well, I don't know. I don't. But over the weekend, apparently Rogers Communications, which provides a great deal of internet service in Canada, had a major outage that affected about 25% of their connectivity. So the outage started on the 8th. And affected pretty much everything from mobile phones to ATMs to 911 service. And yeah, it is 911 in Canada. But the stock answer of this from Rogers CEO was that a maintenance update caused the outage. That was the only statement they provided. And I mean, I know too much X-Files and you start to see conspiracies everywhere. And I will say, everybody, all of us and all of you have pushed a patch a bit too soon or turned off a system only to find out that they had never saved the running conf to the startup conf. And when it came back up, they were like, I don't know, when we don't have backups, I hope you can fix it. So, you know, spin the wheel and maintenance update comes up. It's better than sunspots or whatever. But, I mean, it's better than trying to explain why 20 million Zygons are living amongst us. It's just easier that way. Anyway, Microsoft had put auto-blocking on VBA macros for downloaded documents a while ago. I think it was more than a month. Which was, I thought, a pretty good idea. But they did announce in a very vague announcement that they were temporarily rolling it back last week. They didn't say why. But they did say they were rolling it back temporarily. So based on, and they said it was based on feedback. So I guess a lot of people had problems with the automatic blocking and couldn't figure out how to re-enable it or something. I don't know. But as you might guess, this leads to a lot of confusion for admins since they put it in place and said, and they made a big fanfare about putting it in place. And, you know, and then it caused problems. And then they rolled it back without very much fanfare, but it caused even more problems. And they did all this without really making much of an announcement or instruction or whatever. Bill, call me. I can do a special report or something, really. Just anytime, just day or night. Just give me a ring and we'll do it. And you could be on even, like, and the crew will make you look like super hot, just like they do me. But anyway, honestly, I do think you need to turn this feature on your systems. I really do. People will open anything. I mean, I bet if today we sent out an email from hackyou@hackyou.com and it said in the subject line, "Do not open. Contains incredibly infectious malware that will cause widespread damage and genital warts," somebody would still click on it. I mean, you know they would. So even if they turned it off, you can turn it back on. So, you know, whatever works, but it's something to be aware of. And speaking of Microsoft, they now have another feature that they've added called Auto Patch, which, boy, that just makes me cringe every time. But at the same time, but it's only available currently to enterprise users, and it's free. And I never know how I feel about these things because I don't really like them to auto-update my stuff. Because, you know, then you get up in the morning and they've rebooted your machine and all your stuff's gone and you're like, wait, what happened? And, you know, and this new patch says, oh, you've been upgraded to something and you can't do this anymore. And, oh, yeah, that doesn't work. So, you know, I usually like to wait and see all the news reports of death and destruction. And then, you know, they roll out a wait for it maintenance update. You know, see what I did there? But anywho, they said that a free upgrade to Auto Patch was now available. And if you're enrolled, you move your update orchestration from you to Microsoft. And they will handle the deployment of Windows 10, 11, quality and feature updates, as well as drivers, firmware, and Microsoft 365 apps. Now, I mean, honestly, I mean, that makes me cringe, but for a lot of small and medium organizations, which often make me cringe because they don't do patches or updates, and you look at the machine and you go, you know, and it's sitting there saying, there are 7,416 Windows updates available for this system. And you're going, you realize this is your web server, right? And they're like, yeah, what does that mean? It means you need to update your server every now and then. Oh, really? We just don't have time for that. So they may well benefit from this kind of service, which shifts that up to Microsoft. And they're not doing their patches anyway, so maybe it's a better idea. But if you have an E3 or E5 license, the service is now available. And they do have some steps for setting this up in the article. So if you really want it or you need it, it probably will help some companies quite well. So, you know, you're basically turning it over to Microsoft, but maybe that's really exactly what you want, because otherwise you're probably trusting some 18-year-old kid from the local high school who's doing your security maintenance. The Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States regulates financials and publicly traded companies and a whole bunch of other stuff. And they're basically considering new rules. These rules have not been passed yet, but they're considering new rules on cyber risk management, which may well impact a lot of companies. And I think it's probably going to impact companies at the level of things like Sarbanes-Oxley or Gramm-Leach-Bliley, or HIPAA, which were all very large implementations by the SEC on American and other worldwide companies, because if you're publicly traded in the U.S., then you're subject to a lot of this stuff. So the new rules that are being considered would require senior management to ensure that their companies upgrade cybersecurity detections and response times. It would require that data breaches be disclosed within 4 days and will require disclosures of senior management and board members over their role in oversight of cybersecurity risks, and what kinds of cybersecurity policies they have will have to be disclosed, and the procedures that they use will have to be disclosed, and how likely cyber events are to impact the company's bottom line. And I mean, honestly, it took Sarbanes-Oxley, HIPAA, and Gramm-Leach-Bliley to get companies to do basic cyber hygiene at all. I mean, for years before those things came out, we were telling people, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to do this other thing. And the C-suite people were going, yeah, but that costs money, and I don't know. And, you know, and then they got hacked, and they're calling you back going, oh, why did this happen? Oh, my God. And, you know, and when they passed these laws, it did force them to start auditing and looking at this stuff and reporting it. So, you know, companies only do what they're required to do, so the rules may help start moving things in the right direction, but it won't be pretty and it won't be cheap, although it would probably be good for all of us because, you know, they'll need people to do all this stuff. In a presentation in June by Fred Moore, a veteran storage analyst at Horizon with an S Information Strategies, he said that we have entered the zettabyte era of data storage and that archival storage will be the dominant tech by capacity in the future. So according to this presentation, he said that by 2025, which is, you know, just a couple of years from now, 175 zettabytes of data will be created. And, you know, I think much of it will be TikTok videos of cats missing the countertop and pranksters filling their trousers with live eels. But, you know, if you think about that, I mean, if you aren't up on your Greek prefixes, a terabyte, which we all know and love, can be bundled together by 1,000. So 1,000 terabytes make a petabyte, right? And I think we all know that one. And then, okay, so let's see. Let's test your knowledge of these things as they go forward. So that still sounds like a lot to me, a petabyte. And one of my goals in life was to build a petabyte array. I've never done it yet, but maybe someday. But 1,000 petabytes, so something that's like almost inconceivable, is an exabyte. Now, there are companies that are talking about exabytes, like Walmart and people that collect, you know, unbelievable amounts of transactions and so forth. But 1,000 exabytes is a zettabyte. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, my favorite one, though, there's the last one. My favorite one is 1,000 zettabytes is a yottabyte. That's a whole yottabytes. Waka, waka, waka. Yeah. They don't have a rim shot effect, but if they did, that would be a good place. But anyway, Moore said that 80% of this immense amount of space would mostly be archives, since we have to save everything. Then we back it up and save it again. And then maybe we back it up again so that there's archival data that is not touched by ransomware and all these kind of things. And so that means that archival data, that glacier type storage, is going to be a massive amount of stuff. And nobody ever wants to delete anything, right? I have home movies that my father made in the 1950s in my basement. And we're digitizing them. And then we're going to save those digital images onto archival storage. Yeah. So, you know, films that nobody will ever watch are you know, being uploaded and saved. So he went on to say that archival data has a growth rate currently between 25 and 35% per year, and it's being amassed faster than it can be analyzed. So, I mean, for instance, I just downloaded 4 terabytes of archival video of people's classroom meetings because they did not want them deleted, because they feel like that, you know, someday somebody may want to watch that, you know, introduction to economics class meeting they had back in 2020. And we want to store them long term. So we downloaded them, put them on a storage array, and they're going to sit there in case somebody wants to dig through that and look at it, you know, years from, you know, you off in the future from, you know, someday from now, they'll be like, look at this stuff. But Moore went on to advocate for tape backups over hard drives due to the carbon footprint. And mostly what I've said for a long time, the ability to add capacity quickly, because tapes really do this well. And they're, you know, you can store them in another location and so on. They're a lot faster than they used to be. But he also said new tech was coming about, like glass photonics and 3D holographic storage, which starts to sound pretty Star Trek-y, Doctor Who kind of stuff. It was an interesting article I thought maybe you'd like to read. It was quite interesting to me. Going with the nickname Johnny Flappy, he became the second biggest nudist ever on Survivor after Richard Hatch. Despite the whole electric eel incident and the brutal groin pull, he went on to finish second in Survivor the East River. Please welcome Jason Wood.
Hey, everybody. You know, and I didn't even get anything for that second place finish at all. Just notoriety from Doug here.
There you go.
Not worth the effort, I think. So this story actually is, you know, Doug did a little bit of a kind of quasi feel good story about ransomware. I'm going to do a, you know, less feel good story about ransomware. The Internet, or the Information Commissioner's Office, or ICO, as I will refer to them, in the UK, basically issued a statement late last week with a touch of warning in it to the victims of ransomware. And that is, paying out ransoms does not mitigate risk in their eyes and will not result in reduced fines from them. Now, my first reaction to this is, what are you talking about? Why on earth would paying a ransom reduce fines? Why are you making a statement like this? But apparently, there is some level of belief amongst organizations that the ICO has jurisdiction over, that if we pay the ransom, the bad guys say that they'll delete our data and it won't be exposed publicly and stuff like that. So we've reduced the risk to our, I don't know, the folks whose information is in our data set. And therefore, the ICO should fine us less because of that. And they're basically saying, yeah, that's really not the case. This doesn't reduce any risk at all. And no, as a news flash, the folks who are saying that they will delete all of your data from their systems, they won't sell it to anybody else, stuff like that. Yeah, that's probably really not going to happen. And we really shouldn't believe anything that they say about this when they, as they try to assure victims that how they'll handle this data very seriously. So, you know, the ICO goes on to basically make some comments about how they actually determine risk, or the steps made to mitigate risk. And the first thing off is they say, hey, we would look at and see, did the victim organization learn anything to this? And are they making any changes in response to the weaknesses that allowed this to take place in the first place? Have they reported this to law enforcement is another thing that they consider. And do they take the steps that they have evidence, not even just say that they did it, but have evidence to prove that they are taking actions based on guidance from the National Cybersecurity Center in the UK, NCSC, as I'll refer to them, which I guess would be something like NIST in some ways for us, as far as recommendations on how we need to respond to these things and protect our systems. You know, basically the long story short is they say, hey, are you actually making it more difficult for the bad guys to do this again? Are you learning from the experience? And, you know, if so, then that is mitigating risk. Paying a ransom is not mitigating risk. Now, part of me is a little bit wary of the idea of taking advice without some thought and consideration from any government agency that says this is what you have to do to protect your organization, or not even government agency, any standard or whatever, this laying this down broadly across you, because, you know, that some of the advice may work better in other organizations than in some organizations than others. But, you know, still, they generally have pretty good advice in here and showing that, hey, you know, okay, we're responding to this. We're finally, okay, fine. We'll change our password from password one and we'll put some multi-factor authentication in place and we'll remove RDP from the internet, things like that are all probably really good ideas and guidance that you would get from these organizations. The blog post that I took that I found this in was published by Sophos Naked Security, and they went on to discuss several other aspects that people need to consider in a ransomware attack, and really their stance is kind of in line with what I can remember Paul and I saying and Doug many times. Hey, don't pay the ransom. All we do is provide incentive to these groups to go out and do more of it because they keep making money off it. So if you can, you don't pay the ransom. Now, some organizations aren't really ready. You know, they don't have the capability to respond to recover. So that's a little bit of a different scenario. But there are, you know, I have heard statements that, you know, people saying, well, if we pay the ransom, that'll actually lower the cost of the overall intrusion to us because it'll cost less for us to recover. Probably not. You know, it's going to be similar to restoring from a backup anyway. And it's not unusual to not be able to recover all of the data from these ransomware attacks. Things don't get decrypt cleanly. The tools don't work. Sometimes they just don't work at all. And nobody gets anything back at it, and they're out of luck anyhow. I do have some empathy. As I was reading this, I was thinking about, you know, basically the victims getting kind of hammered here. There's a little bit of a warning here to the victims that, hey, you know, if you pay out, you know, we may come after you even harder because you paid out to a Russian gang and, you know, there are sanctions against Russian organizations. And so there you go. But I do have some empathy for victims of these attacks. This is not an easy decision and is a very difficult time for the victims itself. Actually, earlier this year, I met an owner of a managed IT services provider who got hit with a large ransomware attack spread out to their customers. Basically, they had Kaseya in use. The intrusion actually happened prior to the July 4th attack last year. This was another, you know, thing where they found a flaw either in their deployed instance or cloud hosted. I'm not sure exactly what where the line was there, but either way, a bunch of their customers got ransomed. They had hundreds of servers and hosts that they needed to recover. And the victim had done preparation for this type of stuff. They had backups of all of their systems. They were using another service provider to do that. But what they found out is they had a problem. Well, they had done test restores to make sure things were working properly. Their backup service provider couldn't do hundreds of systems in one go. In fact, they came back. He told me, he said, his provider said, yeah, we think we could do 12 per day. And that was it. And of course, his customers were screaming and wanting their businesses back. So yeah, I mean, the backup system was able, or service was able to do a system here or there, but not anything in a disaster recovery type of situation. And they just hadn't prepared for that. In the end, the ransomware operator demanded $100,000 for decryption keys. They paid that out. They were able to get everything pretty much back up and running. And he talked about the experience about this, and you know, to him, this was just the only road to getting things back up in any kind of timely manner. One of the things I also thought was interesting is he and I discussed the changes he made in this, or the impact that it had, was some of the psychological impact. I mean, you have the technical side, like, hey, let's get rid of this backup service provider and get one that can actually do this at scale. Make sure we're able to recover when all of the systems get nuked at once, whether by ransomware, fire, or hurricane, or whatever. But he also talked about the psychological impacts of this. He actually takes phone calls now from victims of ransomware attacks, because he speaks publicly about this and his experience, and he basically is talking CEOs off the ledge around this and giving them advice like, hey, you know, in the midst of all of this, your life has to go on. You still have to take care of yourself. You have to do things like get a shower. You need to eat food that's actually good for you. You need to go to sleep at night, because this is the impact of undergoing one of these intrusions and how they react to it as their whole business is being held up. So, you know, we can get pretty harsh on folks for paying a ransom or how they handle it or whatever. But, you know, obviously, you look at that type of advice, that's the level of duress these people are experiencing. And so, yeah, decisions are difficult to make at that point. Sophos does give some, you know, what they can, four considerations to keep in mind if somebody decides to pay a ransom. Again, back to the idea of, hey, don't pay out to somebody that might be sanctioned, because you're going to get more fines for doing that and be in trouble yourself. Basically make things worse. Second, obviously there's no guarantee that this is going to work. Ransomware, you know, paying the ransom is probably going to increase your overall cost by the time you're done. And finally, no, regulators are not going to reduce their fines. You know, in the end, ransomware attack is basically a disaster recovery operation with some twists, you know, the data extortion piece in particular. But we need to be able to recover en masse, like everything just got lost or been burned down, and, you know, the building got burned down or something like that. There's going to be a lot of pressure in this situation, and we need to be prepared for that. We need to prepare our, you know, for us in security, our management, our C-suite and stuff like that, to understand, hey, if this happens and we get this type of outbreak, here are going to be the impacts that we're going to have to deal with, and here's what it's going to take. And there's going to be a lot of stress related to this. And it's not enough to say, no, it's not going to happen. We have to prepare at some point that maybe this could happen. And it's a good DR. I mean, we should be doing this for disaster recovery one way or the other. The other side of this is to consider, what are we going to do about the extortion side? The last thing you want to be doing is coming up with your company's policy or response to this while you haven't slept for 48 hours and you have been chugging Red Bulls and eating donuts for 2 days. So, this highlights the need for preparation here, which I think is really the final lesson for all of us. Definitely need some serious attention, consideration by our executives, rather than an afternoon discussion about how we might theoretically respond to something. If this is of interest to you, go ahead and check out the link in the show notes.
All right. Thanks, Jason. And like I always told my people that were asking me, you have to spend the time somewhere. You can spend it now. You can spend it later. It's really just going to boil down to, where do you want to spend it, and how compressed do you want that to be? So the more time you spend now, the better off you'll be, and the less time you'll have to spend not sleeping and drinking Red Bull, which is always a challenge. But yeah, thanks, Jason. And finally, I'm not easily awed, if you know me, but one time I was at my friend Lou's house, and we'd had some drinks, and we drug out one of his giant telescopes and set it up, which took like 4 hours because we'd had some drinks, and we looked at this globular cluster in the sky, and I don't know, I felt pretty insignificant right about then. I was like, what are those things, Lou? And he was like, those are galaxies. And you're like, what? And anyway, but if you haven't seen the James Webb, the first shot that came out of the James Webb telescope, which just got put up yesterday, it will probably make you want to run and hide from the fact that even in this small little chunk of the sky, there were so many galaxies. And all those things are galaxies. They're not stars or asteroids or you know, dust. They're actually galaxies, you know, whole big giant collections of things, all just in that one little pic. I mean, you know, I think that you can, if you look in the lower right hand corner, you can see Gallifrey, but I'm not sure. But wow, it sure made me want to take in, you know, on a continuing mission to explore strange new worlds and seek out new life and new civilizations and to boldly go where no one has gone before, and also to avoid space herpes. Number one, I'm talking to you. No, don't look at that picture of Kirk. It wasn't him. You know that. Okay. And that's the news. Thanks, Jason. We'll see you next on Friday for the wrap-up show.